We have some measures that we would like to introduce. However, they're not finished being drafted. So we're waiting for some more folks to show up. Representative Alan Brown has a particular issue that is being drafted, and we're actually going to kind of introduce the concept as a conversational item and talk about it and take some testimony, but we're not going to do that till 2:30. So we are in recess till 2:30. Thank you.
Okay, don't go away.
I'm going to go away. And we will reconvene today's House Special Session Committee on Economic Growth and Job Development for Thursday, September 5th, 2002. And we again appreciate you all showing up here today. We are going to hear a conceptual idea today. We are not going to work the bill that, what was this? 4072. Today we're still continuing to crunch numbers and try to be creative as we can be. Stay tuned for that bill tomorrow, hopefully shortly after lunch sometime. So today we have a concept that we're going to explore that has been brought forward by Representative Alan Brown. And Alan, why don't you share with us what your basic ideas are, and we'll begin there.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, I'm sure Representative King will be familiar with Blatchley, Oregon, but it's a small, very, very small little community on Highway 36 that sets up in the coast range between Eugene and Florence, or Junction City and Florence, I guess would be more appropriate. There's, I believe, a total of three buildings in town. There's a fire hall and a community hall on one side of the street and a post office on the other, and a corporation with a building there that LRI is the name of the corporation. It's locally owned and established company that started, I believe, in about 1993, and it's the owner developed a proton light that he manufactures locally, and he started out very small and grew the business and and involve the community in contract employment and assembling his product. I believe, and I don't want to share any facts out of school, but Mr. Allen told me their business had reached in the neighborhood of $8 million a year there now, and provided employment for roughly 30 people, full-time positions in this community, and independent contract employees varying depending upon the demand and the orders that they had, from 5 to 70 people in this area. And this is a very, very rural area with the homes very scattered out through the farmlands and the forest area there. This type of arrangement served his business very well, that served rural Oregon very well, and was a, quote, cottage-type industry that provided jobs to people that otherwise would not have employment. And through the interpretation of the independent contractor rules, our employment department notified Mr. Allen that the way he was conducting his business with the independent contractors that he had, that he was in violation of the law and would have to change his business practices. And this issue has been going on for several years, and he recently brought it to my attention, and I thought it was an appropriate enough story to bring to this committee, because one of our concerns is jobs in the economy, and to keep these jobs within this community, he needs to be able to employ independent contractors to keep his business there. He does some business in China now, and my understanding was that there's a real possibility, unless there's some help and relief in some way, that most of this employment may move to a foreign country. And what I would like to do is introduce Mr. Allen. He's brought some other people with him to tell his story to this committee. I've had some legislation down, or some drafted legislation down in the legal counsel's office, and they're working on now, and hopefully we'll bring back some concept to correct this issue. And with that, can we bring...
Absolutely. Mr. Allen, you and whoever else you'd like to have testify, please feel free to come forward, if you would. Welcome to you all, and thanks for making the journey here. Pull your microphones down so that you can speak clearly into them as this meeting is recorded and it's on the internet today.
Okay.
And when each one of you begins speaking for the first time, please be sure that you tell us who you are and basically where you're from, so that we have that for the public record for later on.
All right.
And please, Mr. Allen, proceed. Thank you.
Well, I would like to thank you for hearing this. It's been going on a long time. My name is David Allen, and I invented the photon microlight. We're a patent holder on this and several other products since then. Our company was established to share light in the world, and we have put our products into space. The FBI carry it. The astronauts, cosmonauts, I should say, were also given this as a gift, and on their very next mission, they also carried it. And so you can get a vision of this. This light weighs the same as an American quarter, and it almost hides under that, but it has a visibility of being seen for more than a mile, virtually indestructible, lithium-powered, 10-year shelf life, never burns the bulb out. So this is the 21st century of what flashlights are going to be. Now, we also work on some larger versions of this, but this has been our main product. And when I started this, I had a vision of what a flashlight could be after being frustrated with flashlights that didn't work in my home, broken bulb, you know the story. And in that, I wanted to, I had already lived in the community for 25 years in Blashley and liked living there, and I didn't want to go anywhere else. So we started this business in our home. And until 3 years ago, landed in there, until it actually took over our home. We bought the local general store that had bankrupted after 100 years of business, resurrected that building, and moved into try to employ people in our area, in which we had been doing out of our home. So we have employees in our building, and those are people that work whatever hours. We try to do flexible hours. They are covered as any employee is in the business. However, for our flashlight manufacturing, we chose, because of the vagaries of business and orders and who knows when what comes in and what doesn't, we did original contact with the employment department, is that, is this going to be okay? And that was in 94 that we asked this question. What we got as a message from them at that time, which I was unfortunately too naive to document any more than my memory here, was that, yes, Oregon needs this. You're in a rural community. The mill has closed. The logging is winding down, and this is great. This is just what we're looking for. Well, we went on that and built a company. Well, when we started making millions instead of thousands, I think the radar screen somehow changed, and we got a note from the employment department, as Representative Brown said, that we're out of compliance. Total surprise to us.
What date did you get that notice from?
That was about 3 years ago.
About 3 years. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
And the record should, my connection with years is tenuous. I work on a day to day, and my wife is very good at that, and I'm not. So.
Okay.
We went from doing the subcontractor work, which is what we've mainly been working with all this time, and done very well. The idea is that people make one light at a time, whether they have 1,000 to do or not, and they put the quality into it. And that's been the thing that has built our company, is the fact that all our product works, and it works when it's most needed. And if you look at the website, photonlight.com, you'll see a range of our product, and I urge you to read the testimonials from how we have affected people's lives. It is incredible. I gave brochures that you can see our range as well. So where this has affected us, and one of the things that I think that was the biggest error the employment department has made in their analysis of who we are, is that when we pay for subcontract work, it's by the piece. People can work when they choose to. They have their own tools. They turn in a Schedule C. We turn in 1099s. They have business cards. We work on purchase orders. I cannot follow the rules any more than we have, and yet it still isn't good enough. We've had complaints about the thickness of our business cards, whether they have a separate phone, whether the table's in a different room that they're working on. And what it does is the problem isn't so much that whether they're an employee or not, because I could work with it either way except for the catch-22. If you're an employee, you cannot manufacture in your home. So it kills it one way or the other. It's impossible to take home work if you're an employee. But if you're a subcontractor, you can work and raise your children. And just to give you an example here, all of these are personal letters that were brought by our office this morning when they learned that we were coming up here to say something. And I can either read some of these, or, and Alona and Fran here can also speak on their own. So I really requested that we get some assistance. Never would have this have dawned on me that this would have taken two appeals, which we lost the one yesterday, that, and now the next step is the Supreme Court, and I can't finance it. I never, never would have dreamed that this would have gone this far. I, in my heart, told everyone around me, everyone has to be intelligent here and recognize that what we're doing in our community is offering jobs that otherwise wouldn't have taken place. We estimate we saved 50,000 gallons of gasoline last year from people not having to drive to Eugene or Florence and working in their homes. We paid, as I was saying earlier, by the piece. A person that's adept at making lights can earn between $10 and $20 an hour. That's if they want to work at it. If they want to do less, that's up to them. All we demand is quality and some sort of idea of when you might be bringing these back. They take holidays when they want. As far as I can tell, they're subcontractors. And I'm glad to answer any question or illuminate more. I don't know what more to say.
Illumination is a great word.
Yeah.
No pun intended. Two questions for you. You referenced that, is your understanding the Oregon law, and I don't know the answer to this question, and we'll have to ask, is your understanding the Oregon law precludes an employee from working in their home on behalf of their employer?
Absolutely. A secretary can take home paperwork, but you cannot manufacture. And somehow, and I mean, when you look at this, there's nothing hazardous going on with a battery or two batteries and an LED and a plastic case. It perhaps is a little simpler looking than it is in reality of putting it together, and everyone that has made the lights will attest to that. To make them perfectly requires concentration, but the law still says you may not manufacture at home, and this is assembly of some sort.
I see. Okay. And the second question is, you said you received complaints, I think, beginning in 1999. Were those complaints from the Department of Employment thinking that you were out of compliance, as opposed to complaints from someone else, employees or?
To my knowledge, no one that has worked with us has ever turned in a complaint. And what we learned at the hearing with the employment department is that they wrote the complaint.
Okay.
And it wasn't an employee, as we were led to believe during the entire audit that they did on us.
Oh, really? You were led to believe that it was an employee who had originally made the complaint?
That's how I took it. And I think that's what I got as a prevalent notion from people living in our community, that there was one person that came in and complained, and it started this thing, and there we are. But the hearing, and that person was there testifying on their behalf, but everyone that testified on their behalf stated that we did everything wonderful. They were glad we were there. So I thought, this is going our direction. And
so you're saying that you found out in the hearing that the complaint actually originated from the employment department and not from outside source. Okay. Well, we'll certainly ask the employment department for clarification of that since they're here.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome. I know where Triangle Lake School District is. I'm from Detroit, and we played them in 8-man football.
All right.
Right.
Yeah,
you don't play anymore.
Yeah, who won? Well, you know, small towns, everybody's got to pull together.
I have a couple of questions. Were these laws and rules to which you've been accused of violating, were they in place prior to the beginning of your business?
Yes, they were.
And is there a follow-up, Mr.
Yes, please.
Is there a threshold of your gross manufacturing earnings that triggers in these rules as opposed to a smaller amount of deduction? No. Are there two levels of deduction and you crossed the threshold that put you into new rules?
Not that I'm aware of.
But we are hearing from the...
They are here, and they'll be happy to share their thoughts. President King.
Thanks. I haven't got a chance to get through the awards yet. But, what kind of patent do you have?
Design patents on the photon here, and also application patents on the two new products that we're working with.
Okay.
Registration as well.
I'm trying to get a handle on what your... thing is the problem. Do you have any of your the assemblers, do any of them assemble any other kind of product for any other company?
Some do and some don't.
Okay.
And that's one of the rules in the statutes here that I would like to see changed, because where is it in any other business that demands that you work for someone else to have a job?
Well, actually, I owned a small logging company. We had one cutter that was free to do anything they wanted in their own business, but they did all the work for us.
Right.
Well, by definition, as you see, they were defined to be our employees.
Right. Okay?
So we ended up having to pay, you know, their workman's comp and other issues, and that was why, because they just worked for us. So, you know, it seems like perhaps there's some justification under that principle that for those who do assembly for other companies, that they're legitimately, you know, a subcontractor, because they'll do that for anybody, and they do.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, someone who only does it for you, you're their only paycheck, then, you know, under the laws, they're really designed so that you pretty well assume them as, even though you don't want to claim them as your employee, and they may have some benefits for that, but they are in effect your employee if you're the only one who pays them.
I understand your logic with this, but I see a flaw in it in that the person that's the logging for you had the choice of working for other people if that person so chose. And to have another group of people say that because you chose to work for one person, you're an employee, when they could have done anything else they'd like to. Now, if that person wants to work full-time and then have a half-time job somewhere else to validate their subcontractor, then that's asking someone to do something that they don't really want to do. We have a lot of people working with us that want to work part-time. They want to raise their children, and I have some letters here that I really would like to see you read from people that are 65 years old. This one that hasn't worked since 1972 because of a loss of she's disabled. And she takes lights, works on them for a few hours, and should she be forced to have another job doing something else to manage the ability to do this? I don't think so. I think that if you can take any rule and twist it to where it doesn't work. And I think that what we have offered here with the people in our area at a very good pay rate justifies the fact that we should respect their freedom of being able to choose one job or two or three, but not mandate that they have to have two jobs to have the one. And then the issue comes back again to what I stated about employee. They can't work in their homes. There's a lady here that's raising five children, and Alona has many children. And I think you should probably have her address this one. But the choice has to be from the citizen that is working as to how many jobs that they feel they have to have to work.
I'm not my questions here, but when I talk to business owners like yourself, and I do that a lot, and I run into that circumstance where you end up having people that they're not your employees, you don't want to have, you know, have them as employees, and I've had folks like that too, then I make sure that they're real careful. Say, make sure you don't just work for one person a year. That's how the law is structured. You know, you need to understand that law, and you need to make sure that you go get, you know, at least some work for part of the year for someone else, so you can, you know, cross over for that threshold.
We were pushed as hard in the last hearing that if the person that was working with us wasn't, and this is, I couldn't believe this, if they weren't assembling micro lights for someone else, it meant that they didn't have a second job. So it wasn't that they were assembling or doing some other handwork. It was making micro lights. There is no other micro light business in Oregon.
And hopefully you have all of it. I think that, you know, in terms of, you know, choice, I think that case, you know, is real old, and thousands of companies have bumped into that.
Yes.
But in terms of a circumstance where, you know, someone could be, quote, in the business of doing sub-assembly, and they'll do any sub-assembly, you know, that's out there, and they do some others, and I think you may have a chance to either satisfy or, you know, give us some, you know, direction so we might be able to craft something or dissatisfied, but I saw some confusion in terms of what we're trying to resolve here, because it sounded like I heard you say that one of the issues is that the state doesn't allow you to manufacture in a home, and I've never heard of that, so if that's in statute someplace, I need to get that clarified.
If legislative council is listening, and I hope that they are, if they would be so kind as to have someone come up here and clarify that particular point for us.
Agencies here, too, they might really
right. Yeah. Right.
And I got the book open on this one.
Well, then find it, Representative. You are tasked with that.
If I have questions, then I'll just go on.
Okay. All right. Representative Brown.
I'm just going to say, Mr. Chairman, maybe I think those two ladies would also like to testify.
Well, and I want them to, since they've been nice enough to come forward. Whichever one, please identify yourself and where you're from.
I'm Fran Olson. I've lived in Lake Creek Valley for over 20 years. I'm really wearing four hats here today. First is the director of my food box, of the community food box program. And I seem to call it mine sometimes, and it isn't mine, because I've done it for 10 years. Second, as a former subcontractor. Third, as the mother of a former subcontractor whose husband was stricken with a very aggressive cancer. And fourth, as an employee of LRI for the last 3 years, whose job included both the distribution of parts and the receiving of the product back. Our community has a high poverty rate. Our school furnishes either free or reduced lunches to 65-70% of the students up there. We are 35 miles from employment. Approximately 80 emergency food boxes were distributed last month in an area which encompasses about 70% of these builders. Our food boxes were noticeably increased when the subcontractors were released. Second, my husband and I were subcontractors for David for years. We both worked full-part-time jobs in an inventory service. This allowed us the freedom to earn enough to survive at the end of each year. We filled out all the necessary tax papers and gladly paid ISS and our extra taxes that we owed. My daughter's husband had very aggressive cancer. They were young, did not have a lot of assets to fall back on. She was able to stay at the hospital and help him recover as he went through exhausting, rugged chemo. He could go to sleep, she could build lights. Then she could take care of him when he got up. He had stores from places I don't even want to discuss that had to be taken care of. It provided them with money to pay their living expenses without turning to welfare and keep their heads high. And he's now back on his regular job. As an employee for LRI, I worked with subcontractors. I never found anyone who did not like the freedom or all the aspects of being a subcontractor. They enjoyed this, where, when, and how. They made the decision. The money helped the families. To some of it was a way to raise their children at home without daycare or worry about putting them into a daycare. To others, it added those little extras, like it did in my house. To others, it was their own income. Myself, it represented to all, I can do it myself. I can stay at home. I can take that trip. I can be self-reliant without the help of government agencies. I don't have to take food stamps. That's what building microlights meant to these people. They could do it in their homes. They could watch their children. And their husbands would go off to work, and maybe they'd work 3 hours. And thank you, sir.
Thank you. How long have you been you were a subcontractor first before you became an employee?
Yes. Okay. For a long, long time.
And you did that for quite some time?
Yes, I did it since I started with David probably about 1995, or even earlier. I was one of these first.
I see.
And my husband and I both worked an inventory for Wiz, an inventory service. And between January, when he's slow, from January to March, we were crammed. But say come when he gets back in October, they don't want people, you know, to do inventory. They're in Christmas sales. So we would work for David during those times, or maybe during the summer sometimes. Whenever he needed us, we'd find a little hour or two there. Sometimes we would say, he'd call us and we'd say, hey, David, we can't do it. We're busy. And David accepted that, and that was part of our agreement with him. We didn't have to work unless we wanted to.
So you, I made a note that you really feel this concept works well for rural families, that particularly people who are perhaps disabled and disadvantaged, it's really is a nice fit for their lifestyle.
It is an excellent fit. It's an excellent fit. In our community, we have mothers who would have, there is no daycare in my area at all. In fact, I'm only a grandma one time because of that. But,
right.
There is no daycare. So in order to work, these women would have to take their children, pack them up at 6 o'clock in the morning, pack them into your jeans, put them in a daycare, go to work, pick them up at 5 or 5:30, and they wouldn't get home until 7. Meanwhile, what do you do with the children that are at school? What do you do with them between 3 and 6? You would have a tremendous amount of latchkey kids. And that isn't fair to the child. They're out in the country. They don't belong in a latchkey program. I mean, there isn't a neighbor next door that they could bang on if something happened. I mean, in my case, I live 10 miles from work. And that's close. If I went to town, I would go 45 miles.
I see.
One way to get to town to work anymore.
Well, Fran, thanks for your comments there. And please, tell us your name and where you're from.
Yeah, I'd like to take an opportunity to introduce myself. My name's Alona Hartwig, and I'm the wife of, I've been married for 20 years. I'm the mother of 6 beautiful children. My family moved into the Triangle Lake community almost 9 years ago. During this time, my husband was the only one who was financially supporting our family. We decided when we were young and when we got married that one of us would stay home and help with the rearing of our children. 5 years ago, I met an amazing man by the name of David Allen, who invented an incredible micro personal flashlight. There was a need to have these parts assembled to produce the photon microlight. This was the beginning of many blessings to our family. I would bring home parts, I would assemble them, and then take them back to be packaged. For the first time in my life, I realized that I felt like I was really contributing financially to our family, and I was helping my husband say that. And more importantly, it allowed me to stay at home with my children. Being my own boss and working my own schedule, I never had the need to take a day off without pay because one of my children is sick. I could support our community and our school by having plenty of time to volunteer. Being an independent contractor made our decision to have a 6th child easier, knowing that I would be able to work my own schedule. I was my own boss. I decided when I would work, how much I would work, and what hours I wanted to work, and so on. 2 years ago, I bought a beautiful Suburban to haul all of our family in. This never would have been possible had it not been for the income that I was making and contributing by working at home. Now I find myself faced to leave home to work, let my car go back, not being available to volunteer at school or in our community. No more field trips, no more classroom parties, no more school dances, no more cheering on my children while they participate in sports. And this is not my decision, but a decision made for me by people who do not understand or support us as contractors. And I would like to say that, yes, I am an independent contractor. I'm angry that I'm being told that I can no longer work in my home and be with my children. This causes my husband and I to depend more on our older children to help with the child care, or we face the choice to have to pay for child care. I'm no longer making extraordinary wages of $15 to $20 an hour for part/full-time work. to give you an idea of what my days were sort of like. I would get up in the morning while my family was still sleeping and maybe start working on some lights for an hour before I would get the kids up and get them ready for the day. Would make them breakfast and rotate some laundry and change some diapers. And then I would sit down at the table again and build for maybe a half an hour. And then I would take some time out and sit and play with my toddlers, and we would build with blocks or go out in the sandbox and come in and fix lunch. And then I would sit maybe while they were napping for an hour or however long they were sleeping, and I would produce light. This allowed me time to, well, while I was building, I could also be on the phone and schedule some doctor appointments or dentist appointments. What I'm trying to say is it was the perfect world. Or it was. I could be a wife, a mother, and I could work in my own home. Being an independent contractor allowed me to make choices for myself, like, do I want a business phone? Do I want to hand out business cards? All decisions were my own. I live about 3 miles from LRI versus the 30-plus miles to town. I would spend an average of 7.5 hours a week just riding to and from town for employment without pay, only to make less than I was making at home. I want to watch my children grow. I want to read to my 2-year-old son, Logan, and play with him in the sandbox. I want to bake cookies with my 5-year-old son, Wyatt. I want to chaperone my daughter, Cassidy's school dances. I want to go to all of my 15-year-old son, Miles. I want to go to all of his games. I want to help out this year with the senior class that my 18-year-old son, Skyler, is part of. And finally, I want to be home when my 20-year-old son, Ty, calls with excitement that he just got a new job. All this is going to be possible just as soon as I start working at home again. Last spring, my husband and I decided to become foster parents, and we want to open our hearts and our home. We want to help, love, and nurture a child in need. We plan to give this child the same love, support, and encouragement as we do our own. I like to be home to be able to spend that quality time with this child. Well, there, whatever your decision, you must know will dramatically affect our entire community, and I pray that it will affect us for the best. Thank you.
Thank you, Alana. That was very poignant testimony. And I have to say that I have, being from rural Oregon myself and a fifth-generation farmer, I really believe that we need to make as many opportunities available for people who live in rural Oregon to enjoy the way of life we have, but prosper. It is an absolute fact in the last decade of economic growth in this state, rural Oregon has not benefited to the extent nearly as what the more urbanized areas of the state have. Some places in Oregon, we've lost population in rural communities because there are no jobs. And living in a small town and having that kind of quality of life is a marvelous opportunity. And I think we as a state should try to do everything we can as a matter of policy to encourage those types of things. Not everyone wants to live in the big city. In fact, a lot of folks want to leave the big city to live in the country because of the quality of life. But it's tough when you can't make a buck. And I think we ought to really explore not only this issue, but other issues, and that's sort of what we're trying to do here, to create jobs and opportunities all over the state, including rural Oregon especially. So, members, do you have any questions of Alana? Okay. You have him on the phone? Okay. Why don't you all step aside for a bit, and we will have perhaps in a few moments some legal definition, and in the meantime we'll have the employment department come forward, if you would please, and sort of give us your perspective. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you are?
Representative Krupp, my name is Renee Bryant, R-E-N-E-E-B-R-Y-A-N-T. I'm the manager of the tax section of the employment department. I've been on the job for 1 month.
electricity.
Okay. My name is Jane Martin, and I'm with the Employment Department, and I'm the manager of our special projects unit in the tax section. I've been on the job for a little bit longer.
Please continue. My apologies. We're just trying to figure out the logistics here to talk to the proper person at the Legislative Council who is trying to answer this one particular legal question for us. So please continue, if you would.
Chairman Krupp, I'm not quite sure where to begin. I guess I can start out by saying that I've worked with Employment Department Law at the Department of Justice beginning in 1985. I was an attorney in private practice in employment law before that, and I've worked in the Employment Department for the Employment Appeals Board for about 16 years prior to working for the tax section. I'm aware of no Employment Department law that prohibits the manufacture or assembly of flashlights or anything else in the home. So, to the extent that this is a discussion relative to a law that has impacted the LRI business in that respect, it's not an Employment Department law.
But that doesn't necessarily mean it's not in the statute somewhere necessarily.
The only thing I can think is that perhaps there's an OSHA statute or something that has impacted. Maybe Mr. Allen can tell us whether or not he's received notices of violation or interaction with other state agencies could help us more clearly identify what that might be.
Okay.
With respect to the Employment Department, to my knowledge, this arose as a result of someone having filed a claim for an employment insurance benefit who listed LRI as an employer, or somehow these wages were attributed to LRI as an employer. An investigation was begun, and so that's how the Employment Department became involved in this. The Employment Department has an obligation to determine whether or not employment relationships exist between parties in order to determine whether or not employers should pay employment taxes, payroll taxes, as most people know them. And for individuals who work for entities who are employers and then who later become unemployed through no fault of their own, they're able to claim unemployment insurance benefits. So, for instance, if LRI is not an employer and all the people who work for them are not employees, then if those people become unemployed, stop doing that work for LRI, they're not entitled to receive unemployment insurance benefits based upon those wages. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Did you have a question, Rex?
I'm familiar with that. As a farmer, we're not required to pay unemployment benefits because I know it's typically seasonal labor and so forth. So the investigation began as a claim for unemployment benefits.
Correct.
And they listed LRA as an employer, when, in fact, your understanding was they were a subcontractor.
To my knowledge, the issue arose because someone asserted they had received wages from LRI. The Employment Department then had to make a determination whether or not that was an employment relationship and that those wages were subject to taxation and so forth. So in doing that, an audit was conducted. The auditor went through the records and examined the work that the individuals performed relative to the relationship of LRI, and determined that those under the existing statutes that had been in place since about 1989, that the individuals performing the assembly work in their homes were employees under the law rather than independent contractors as they understood themselves to be. And this is a very common situation for many businesses and individuals to find themselves in, because it feels very comfortable in a lot of situations to establish informal relationships, call themselves independent contractors, without knowledge or understanding of the law. And so, again, the Employment Department's job is to go in and clarify those issues, help people understand legal obligations. One of the things that has concerned me is that there appears to be a feeling that the Employment Department has been telling folks that they can't work for LRI. They can work for LRI as much as they want to. The issue that we have is that under existing statute, we believe that the wages they earn are
subject to payroll tax. That's the only issue that we have.
Do you recognize any of LRI's subcontractors as being legitimate at this time?
There are a number of tests in the statute, Representative Krupp. I apologize, I'm losing my legislative adequacy here in addressing you. There are a number of tests in the statute. 670-600, I believe, was the one that was enacted in 1989, which has a list of about 8 separate criteria that individuals need to meet to be considered independent contractors. In addition, there's the criteria called independently established business. And that's the one that most people tend to fall through the cracks on, quite frankly. In order to be an independently established business, and I think you heard some of this from some of the individuals who testified a few minutes ago, there's an expectation that you have invested something, that you're running a business, that you're out seeking work from other people, that you don't have really a dependent relationship on one enterprise. And in evaluating the individuals who have performed the work for LRI, the employment department determined that these were not independently established businesses, as he just referred to the 65-year-old woman who sort of wants to work when she wants to. She's probably not in a business that's going out and soliciting additional business to perform assembly work. If an individual was in the business of doing assembly work and they spent some time assembling jewelry, sometimes assembling baskets, sometimes assembling light bulbs or flashlights, that individual might qualify as someone who would be considered an independently established business and not subject to employment department law for purposes of taxation. But the employment department did not find any of the individuals in this case to have met that test, and the court upheld the position of the employment department in the case that went to the appeals court.
So there are no, and the employment department has determined, has been upheld in court, that there are no legitimate subcontractors under the definition of the law working for LRA.
Correct.
Is that correct? Okay. So next question is your definition or interpretation of the statute so rigid? And I think you just alluded to, if you were a real sub-assembly contractor for a company, you would be able to offer your services not only for lights but for baskets, those types of things that you just alluded to. You wouldn't be saying, as I think one of the, maybe Mr. Allen had said, that a true subcontractor under the definition of the law would have to sub-assemble for another company that made microlights in Oregon.
No, there's no interpretation that I'm aware of that someone would have to do exactly the same type of work. It could only be for making microlights. I believe Mr. Allen said that in the hearing, he came away understanding that was a requirement. I don't know what the hearing officer said, but as head of the tax section, I'd say if I were looking at this and there were an individual who performed various types of assembly work, as a business, soliciting trade from various other groups, that would satisfy me.
And are you the person that needs to be satisfied here in the employment department?
We would make a decision based upon the input of the director as well, I think.
Okay. That is an appropriate answer, and I understand why.
If I may address
the
opportunity.
Sure, please. And you are?
My name is Jane Martin with the Employment Department. I'm a manager in the tax section. When we look at the issue of working for one or more, for two or more businesses or such, Renee was talking about the independently established business. And in 670-600, which is the definition for independent contractors, which is also used by the Department of Revenue and Construction Contractors Board, there are 8 criteria that all 8 must be met. And in the 8, the last one, the 8th one, there are 6 indicators of an independently established business. And of those 6, 4 must be met. And the working for 2 or more different persons within the period of time is one of those 6. So an individual could not meet that item in the 8th criteria, but meet 4 of the others. and still be determined to be an independent contractor under 670-600.
So you have, at least in this case anyway, you have very little administrative flexibility that you can utilize in the meeting of 4 out of 6 criteria. You're saying you have to stay pretty rigid to that?
It's the legal definition, and it's, we have cases that have talked to whether you need to meet all 8, and that is, I don't have a case name, but it is a court of appeals case that says you do have to meet all 8, and it is definitely in the law that the 8th one, you have to meet 4 of the 6. So it is statutory.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a ruling or information available to show us item by item on the 8 criteria, which were met, which were not met, and then including the subcategories of the 6 under item 8? Is that information available to us?
Representative Hoffman, thank you very much. The hearings officer in this case issued the written decision, which went through each section of the statute, and he determined for each section whether or not LRI met that criteria. And I can get you a copy of that hearing decision if you'd like. That decision was appealed to the court. The court affirmed without opinion, so that decision basically stands as is. And I'd be happy to get a copy of that for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be helpful, I think, to at least understand what the nuances are of the law.
I think Mr. Allen has a copy of that, and I believe that Ray will make those copies and distribute it to committee members. President King. That'd be fine, Ray. Thanks.
For the originating claim, was that person fired, or did they just choose not to work for LRI?
President King, I don't have knowledge of that.
If the person's fired, are they eligible for unemployment benefits promptly?
Representative King, Jan, that depends on a variety of factors. An individual is eligible or qualified to receive unemployment insurance benefits if they are discharged not for misconduct or if they quit for reasons that are determined to be good cause.
Okay. Yeah. So if a person is fired, then you know, hiring and firing is one of the definitions of employment, right? So, but of course, a claimant could, let's say, do work that the employer or the company thought was inferior and say, well, we're not going to use your services anymore, and then a claimant could consider themselves fired in that circumstance, even though that may not have been an employer action.
Representative King, that's correct, and a lot of these issues arise through those kinds of situations where individuals consider themselves to be in non-employment relationships, but then when someone is no longer performing work, they go out and file a claim because suddenly they feel like they probably were an employee.
Okay. Now, to go on to, you know, some of the assemblers who you are regarding as employees, but they're in the subset where they do other assembly. My understanding is that in the dialogue between yourselves and LRI that there hasn't been any discerning of the two categories. So, you know, here's a group of folks and they only assemble for us, and here's another group of folks and they assemble other products for other people and would therefore be in a different category. So, am I true that that's kind of status and therefore you don't have any determination to go and, plus if there's 60 assemblers, to go and evaluate each 60 cases and find out that 40 are employees and 20 are not? You just kind of all lump them all together?
Representative King, what the Employment Department does in a situation like this is they will go out and evaluate each individual. And we have had numbers of cases where, in fact, certain individuals were determined to have met the criteria and others were not. And when the audit is completed, we pick up wages for only those that were determined to be employees. And I believe Jane has something she wants to add.
Yes, Representative King. Also, in addition, if you have an assembler who did some other assembly work, in addition to doing assembly work for 2, they also have to meet 3 more of those 6 in Section 8 of the law. So, and my understanding, I don't have it all in front of me, my understanding is many of these assemblers did not meet any of the six in Section 8. So some may have met the working for more, two or more, or, but and also had business cards, but they may not have met the others. So they have to meet four of those six in Section 8, and one of those is the working for two or more businesses.
We may have the statute around. I'd like to take a look at it.
Until we get some clarification on the other issues, then has the agency ever addressed, having any exception based upon, certain mileage from an incorporated city or any issue like that?
No. Referencing no. Chairman Cup?
Yes.
If you would like, I can go through and read briefly. I don't have my glasses on, but
that happens to all. Please, feel free.
With respect to ORS 670-600, first requirement is direction and control. The hearing officer concluded that LRI satisfied that section of the law, that they were free of direction and control in the assembly of the product. The employment department sort of kind of disagreed with that, but this is what the hearing officer concluded, and we didn't appeal that portion of the decision. Subsection 2, obtaining assumed business registrations licenses. The hearing officer held that although no assembler had registered a business for assembly work with the state, county, or any city that would be responsible for attaining such they would be responsible for obtaining such authorization. Therefore, they satisfied that requirement of the law. Number 3 was furnishing tools and equipment. The hearing officer concluded that LRI satisfied that requirement. Authority to hire and fire. Pardon? Ms. Martin has explained to me that we had several issues with some of these conclusions of the hearing officer, but again, we did not contest that at the Court of Appeals. Authority to hire and fire, the administrative law judge concluded that they had failed to satisfy that section of the law. Said that although LRI did not prevent assemblers from hiring and firing others, that in fact nobody had employees, they didn't do it. They paid some children to do some assembly work, but that wasn't an employment relationship, and there was no authority to hire and fire in those situations.
And you're talking about the assembler, not LRI?
Correct.
Representative Cox, this one, I believe our attorney at the Court of Appeals disagreed with the Department of the ALJ's decision and actually felt they met this one.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah.
Number 5, payment for labor or services. The hearing officer concluded they satisfied that section. Number 6, registration under Chapter 701, concluded that wasn't relevant in the situation.
Okay.
Filing a Schedule C as an independent contractor, there was some large discussion about this. LRI failed to satisfy subsection A. LRI failed to satisfy subsection B, which requires labor services be carried out in a separate location and commercial advertising or business cards be a recognized part of the business process.
Can you speak up a little bit, please?
Excuse me. The second part being that business cards or advertising be part of the business process to show that you are actually conducting a business. C, telephone listing. LRI failed to satisfy that subsection. D, labor service performed only pursuant to written contracts. LRI failed to satisfy that subsection. E, labor services performed for two or more different persons within 1 year. LRI failed to satisfy that subsection. And F, assumption of financial risk or responsibility. LRI failed to satisfy that subsection as well. And what the ALJ is saying here is that LRI failed to prove that the relationship based upon the conduct of those independent contractors, as they were termed, satisfied the legal requirements. So and I believe this is what Ms. Martin was talking about previously when she said that this is the section where you can satisfy 4 of the 6, and LRI, in fact, satisfied none of those to show that the employment relationship was other than employer-employee.
have a couple of questions for you.
Certainly.
Is there a legal difference in terms of employment department law defining what is manufacturing and what is assembling?
Not to my knowledge, Representative Clark.
Okay, that's okay. So, was there any contention in the appeals process that, if there's no definitive legal difference in the definition of manufacturing or assembling, and in this case, it's considered to be the same. The fact that subcontractors are actually just putting the thing together, not actually producing the lithium batteries, not producing those types of things. Is that correct?
Representative Krupp, from the standpoint of employment department law, we don't care what the activity was. We care what the relationship was. And so you're correct in saying that we don't make a distinction between an assembly or a manufacturing process.
So there aren't other issues such as OSHA issues of the lithium battery being considered to be hazardous materials. That was brought up in the case. Let me ask you that.
To my knowledge, that has not been a matter that was considered or brought up relative to the audit or the application of employment department law.
Okay. Is there a difference in your mind between this and stuffing envelopes for people?
In terms of the activity or in terms of the relationship with the
Well, meeting the legal definition of subcontractor under this statute, 670-600.
Representative, I'll give you a lawyer's answer, and that would depend on the specific facts of each case have to be analyzed relative to the specific requirements of the statute.
So perhaps not.
Correct.
Okay. Do you think that there are legitimate differences of the needs of subcontractors in their ability to comply with the current statute, differences between urban and rural individuals, such as commercial advertising, business card exchanging? If you're miles from any large city, and there's many places in Oregon like that. In one case of, I think it was Fran, is 10 miles from LRI, obviously very rural. It's kind of hard to do commercial advertising in a very, very small rural community. So I'm talking about the statute perhaps being a bit rigid in its strict interpretation, as you've indicated is the case because of appeals court rulings. Is there, in your mind, some difference of the needs between the ability of rural individuals to meet the strict definition of the statute compared to urban?
Representative Krupp, after a month on the job in the tax section, I have to be very careful how I answer this because I don't want to get my personal opinions mixed up with the opinions of the Employment Department. And I cannot represent to you that I've had a conversation with our director which would accurately reflect her concerns with respect to this.
Fair enough. I'll accept that. Because I don't want your personal opinion.
Thank you.
I want the opinion of the department. President King, did you have a comment or a groan of utter disbelief over there? Is that it? Or okay. I think that sort of concludes my questions personally. Representative Lowe, you look like you're ready to ask some very probing questions, are you not?
No.
Okay.
Thank you. I did this.
Representative Brown, did you have any questions to ask of the Employment Department this time? Okay. Yes.
Do you have some sort of a chart or a cheat sheet that kind of shepherdizes for us the different parts of statute, the eight parts and then the six parts? Do you have cases that I can?
Let me ask Ms. Martin.
Thank you.
excuse me. Could you repeat the question, Representative Lowenthal?
I'm wondering if you have some sort of a resource to which I might turn that will shepherdize the different parts of the statute so that I can look at the case law and ascertain for myself.
I'm not sure if we do at this time. We can research that and end up
sure.
It is somewhere. I'm not sure where it is right now.
Representative Lowe, I'm not aware of anything like that existing right now. We'd have to ask our attorneys at the Department of Justice to prepare something for us. Right now, while we generally use the statute itself, there have not been very many important judicial decisions since 1989 that have changed the application of that in a significant way.
Is that because the statute's fairly straightforward?
That's my opinion, Representative.
Okay.
Would you like for me to do that for you?
If one exists, fine, but otherwise don't make anybody break their vow. I can do that research myself, perhaps.
Thank you.
One of your many staffers do it for you, correct?
What staffers?
That's quite a joke around here. Lastly, the handout that was provided us by Representative Brown of a particular article from Brainstorm magazine is called A View from the Planet Lars, based on Lars Larson's various commentary. And in it, he sort of alludes to and talks about this particular story. And I wanted to ask you about one of the lines in here. And basically, and I'll read the sentence to you, and I think Mr. Allen alluded to it earlier, and I'd like to kind of get back to the criteria and the strictness of interpreting that. Lars says, now the state of Oregon says that people can't be independent contractors in part because they don't maintain separate phone lines and their business cards aren't thick enough. So, and I think Mr. Allen talked about business cards not being thick enough. What on earth would that have to do with the determination that someone was meeting the criteria 670-600?
Representative Clark, I have no idea. This is a mythology that has sort of taken on a life of its own. I am not sure what kinds of comments may have been taken out of context to come up and create that mythology, but I can imagine situations, for instance, in which individuals have been required by a contractor to obtain business cards and not knowing what else to do because they want, in fact, subcontractors in those cases, they might have gone out and Xeroxed something. And the obvious result of that may have been looked at by an auditor and said, well, this isn't a business card. This is some individual trying to do what he or she was told to do. I'm only imagining that. I have no actual knowledge of anything like that having taken place.
Okay.
That's the only thing I can think of.
All right. Fair enough. Jane, anything to add?
Not at this time.
Okay. Any additional questions, members? Okay.
I think it might help clarify, since we're not finding anything in statute about a manufacturer in a home, if Mr. Allen was able to give us any clarification about, where he, gained that assumption. That could be, land use codes, that could be OSHA, but it doesn't appear to be part of
employment law per se.
Yeah.
Ladies, thank you. Joan, you want to, you were on the line with Doug McKeon and perhaps the surmise in legal terms that Representative King just shared with us from your perspective.
Yes, Chair Joan Robinson, Legislative Council. I checked Doug down at the bar. And
which bar? You can tell him I said that too, by the way.
At the Oregon State Bar, we're here attending a meeting of the Oregon Law Commission, that august body that takes our staff away from us. And based on the question that Ray asked him, and it's not a question that I saw because I wasn't following this hearing, Doug pointed me to 670.600, subsection 8, which is what these people have just been discussing. So I assume that the question is something about how you qualify as an independent contractor for purposes of unemployment taxes, workers' comp taxes, and all of that. Now, if the question is something different from that, if it's, as I understand it might be, is there a prohibition on manufacturing things in your home, then Lieutenant King is quite correct. We need a little more information before we can even begin to answer it. I don't think you can think, sorry, sound like a lawyer, but...
You are one.
But I am one.
And that's what you're paid for. So why don't we have Mr. Allen, would you come forward, and Jim Welch, would you also come forward at the same time? Mr. Allen, was it your understanding that maybe this might have been an Oregon OSHA requirement or prohibition against manufacturing in the home?
I can answer this and a couple other things I'd like to clear up.
All right.
Well, the thing about the home is that if you are an employee for a company, and how is it that if someone falls down in front of the kitchen sink, that I, as the employer, am supposed to recognize their homes? Do I need to go and inspect everyone's homes, bathrooms, porches, swings, electrical? That makes it a total catch-22 impossibility for liability for my company.
That gets into the ergonomics situation.
Totally.
Yeah.
I'm not overseeing it. We've never taken that tack.
Okay.
And the other thing you asked about how that original claim happened, the person was a man living in our area. He's a carpenter. He hurt his back to the point that he could not be a carpenter anymore. He applied with us as asking that he would like to be a subcontractor. He learned how to make the lights. He was successful in that training and was able to turn out a perfect product. And then later on, he went into the employment department to gain unemployment benefits for his previous carpentry job. And on that list is where LRI showed up. And they forced him to take the unemployment. We've had several other people that have been in for other jobs that they've had and stated the fact, I am a subcontractor for LRI. This is not money for me. And they said, what do you care? And I can give you those people's names. And this is what they reported to us. And the employment department, since they've made their distinction, pays the unemployment money to anyone that comes in and asks for it. So it's not that someone comes in for LRI to be as a subcontractor to get unemployment money, but for another reason. And then the unemployment money, I think even Fran had that. That it shows up on their check without being asked.
Okay.
The business card thing came out in the last hearing that I attended, and it was looking at the cards. Some of them were handwritten. I was a custom gold and platinum smith for 25 years. I didn't have a business card for 20 years. I hand wrote my name on a piece of paper. If people valued my work, they would keep that piece of paper. So the thickness or the complexity or the professionalism of a card is a person writing their name. And a separate phone in the state of Oregon, your name is your business. So if it's David Allen Jeweler, which was my company, you don't have to register it. There is no need. That is a legal entity in the state of Oregon, fortunately recognized, as long as your name precedes what you do. If your name's in the phone book, then that is just as good as a business line. I never had a separate line to be a jeweler. I did custom work for people, and that was a choice. So I find some of these arrangements here a little difficult. One of the other ones that I just heard was that our subcontractors did not have the right to hire and fire. We have several subcontractors that hired other people. In fact, it got us into a little bit of trouble because they overproduced. We were, in our business, looking at how much people could produce and putting out purchase orders on that level, and some of the people hired other people in their area, a neighbor that was close enough by, or friends, or a brother or sister, and they started producing more, and we got caught, and we built too much product. And this is exactly from them being able to hire and fire.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Representative King,
I'll clarify a little bit. so was it workman's comp that then was saying that that you're not able to manufacture or assemble in home?
No one has told us that we can't. It's just that as a business decision, as a company, I can't take the liability of saying you're my employee, which is supposedly under my direction, which in reality they own their own tools, they work on their own time, they work in who knows what circumstance, and I don't feel it's my right or need to inspect everyone's home and, quote, their working space, that it meets my expectation, OSHA's expectation. So no one has brought that to us. I feel that it's not my business to go in anyone's home. So I won't go there.
Okay. What I had understood you'd say was that the state of Oregon said that you couldn't do manufacturing a home, and that was one of the reasons why
I was
able to work with.
I apologize.
I think so. You were stating an opinion, not a
yes.
You know, not a statement from a state agency.
Yeah, no one has directed us that we can't. It is the catch-22 with taking that liability, and I apologize.
That was the legal issue we've been exploring.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
And then when you had the person go out and they hired people on their own,
yes,
you didn't instruct that, and you know they were acting on their own authority. Did you tell them to terminate that practice, or was that their own business?
That's totally their own business. We have to put purchase orders out that meet what we're selling. Otherwise, we fill up a storage room.
I understand that.
But we've never stopped anyone from any practice. It's they're totally independent.
So then, do they agree to a quantity with you?
We give a purchase order and they fill it. And what we did previous to this was in a very rapid growth that anybody that wanted work, we would write a purchase order for it, because having subcontractors that also, it's like Alona was stating, she has certain times a year she could work with this and certain times not, and the same thing with Fran and many other people. We were taking opportunity if someone was able to do more than what we really needed at that time, fine. Get it made and get it in storage because we're going to sell it. What happened was is that the storage was burgeoning with extra products before we realized that the number of people taking purchase orders exceeded what we really needed or that we could really sell in this calendar year.
Okay. Tim, for the record.
Chairman Krupp and members of the committee, I'm Jim Welch representing Oregon State Grange, and David Allen was a previous constituent of mine in my old district, and I'm also here on a personal nature, very much so supporting his efforts here and have for the last 3 years. You know, he came to me about 3 years ago when I was at the tail end of my service as state representative and soon to be term limited, and tell you what, I went through the statutes piece by piece, and I was just appalled at what I read and how I felt it was arcane today, that it just isn't relevant to the 21st century. And I'd like to get it on record now that we take this into the next session, or if you want to take it on presently. I know that you have budget issues to take on, but we need to change, as I see it. The real issue here is what we have in ORS 316, 448, 656, 657, 670, 671, and 701 regarding independent contractor standards. And they appear in so many ways to be biased against a lot of special situations as we see in Oregon, as we see throughout the United States. Things have changed. The independent contractor, which I am myself. And what if someone offers me a substantial contract on a monthly basis that sustains me and keeps me very busy? And I comply with all the other criteria here, but you know, and I could work for someone else, but I don't have the time. And I, at that point in time, I don't decide to hire someone else to work with me, to bring them on too. And then I would be out of compliance if I worked for an extended period of time or if I got caught in a situation and made an example of, such as David Allen and his company. So you see, I believe that in everything that you've heard in their testimony, that we have a situation here due to the geographic location of the business, of the number of people that are needing this type of work, that we need to change statutes. We need to take some real time establishing something that will get us into a new era, that will keep people off unemployment, help people to substitute some dollars, help the spouse in a lot of situations, as you've heard, help people to live in a rural area. And the Oregon State Grange was very successful, and I helped during their special session they have annually. They had it in Eugene, Oregon in June, and we established policy on this issue. And we have about 4 pages of it, in which we will put into a piece of legislation very possibly. We want to work to change what we think is way out of date. So many, and let's talk about some of the contractors that are out there that are working at home for someone across the United States, maybe someone in Ohio, someone in New York, and very possibly, yes, they have a business card because they're an independent contractor, but they establish they're going to work on their own, and yes, if that work falls off, they'll contract with someone else, but for an extended period of time, they'll be only working with one individual, one company, as a subcontractor.
Representative Wells, or excuse me. Sorry. My apologies. Representative Lowe, it's just a question.
Did you mind if
I can't? Oh, absolutely.
Right. I want to focus in on a couple of things that we've been dancing around this, but we haven't really gotten to it. What are the public policy reasons for listing the criteria in the statute in the manner in which they're listed? And then on the flip side of it, I don't know about the negotiations in your particular case or the status of your case or anything, but I'm assuming that we're talking about some considerable fines and penalties here.
We chose early on to pay everything that was asked of us. And with a letter stating we don't agree with one penny of what you're asking us here because we have followed all these rules, but we are absolutely current and up to date on every dime.
So go and sin no more is not a possibility to end this matter? Or I'm trying to find a way that there can be a win-win. So the people can continue to work if they so choose under certain rules. But the employees are protected in the event of whatever employee protections they need. Workers are protected. And you can continue to function. I don't understand. I guess I don't understand the fight here.
I can answer this in pretty easily. One is, if you look at, I'm going to use an example of the Register Guard in Eugene. They have paper carriers, and several of these people came to work with us after and quit their independent subcontract job with the Register Guard. Now, this is recognized as an independent subcontractor. They have to show up at a certain time. They have to deliver a certain paper to a certain place. They have to do collections, and they also can't work with any other paper because they're handling this. Now, that's an independent subcontractor that's agreed upon because somehow there's dispensation in this state that paper handlers can do this. Now, that breaks every rule that the employment department has. The same thing with a siding contractor, putting siding on buildings. They can build a huge housing district that takes more than a year, but they're not an employee, even though they've only worked for one company that entire year. That's been approved. So a lot of companies through either lawyers or legislative ability, and I'm not sure where either one of those is, but have reached an agreement that it's okay that they do what they do, even though it is flagrant that this is so opposite of what we do. Now, we have brought in, Alona is now working in our building as an employee doing what she used to do at home, and she's making less money. I have been to China 10 times in the last almost year and a half. I am happy to hire Oregonians and my neighbors. This is what I want to do. That rate is, as I stated, $10 to $20 an hour. The same work I can bring from China for $3.50 a day. Now, I have chosen, and my wife and I, when we started this business, we wanted to bring business to our area because it's depressed. And when I came up with the whole idea of the flashlight, it seemed perfect for them. Now, since then, in the last 2 years, I have had to start this trip to China because I want photon microlights not to die because I can't have them made. And I refuse to move to Eugene into an industrial park, which is the zoning necessary for manufacturing, and sit in a metal building and drive from my home in the country when I am a mile from work. So as a win-win situation, I don't see any way possible in the last 3 years that I can keep people working in the country and still have any kind of relationship with the government. And I want to. I am happy because we've built into our product American wages. I only stand to make more money if I'm driven out of Oregon. And that's not really what I choose to do. But I'm backing it up because I want our company to survive. And therefore, I have manufacturing facilities in China, and they keep asking me, why don't you bring over the rest of this? And I explain that it's a big world, and I have friends in Oregon just as I have friends in China.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up question? Thank you. Could I have a follow-up answer on the policy part of my question from the agency, please?
Sure. You're
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Appreciate it. See what the flip side is.
Sure.
By the way, Mr. Allen, I want to applaud you for making a decision to actually take less money out of your company's profitability to hire workers here in Oregon and subcontractors here in Oregon and provide the employment that you do and the income for those families. I think that's very honorable of you, and I think we need more Oregonians like you, frankly.
Thank you.
So, if I may, Ms. Bryant, whose ox is getting gored, and how does this hurt the workers? Please tell me policy. I realize you've been on the job for 1 month, my dear.
I believe that what Mr. Allen was alluding to earlier was the fact that there are numerous specific exclusions in the law which say that for purposes of unemployment insurance law, certain kinds of work will not be considered employment. What that means is that they won't be taxed, the wages won't be taxed, and those wages won't be used to compute benefits for an unemployment insurance claim. And he's correct that there are a number of elected public officials, for instance, are excluded from employment, the definition of employment.
And get stuck out of office again, get done.
Probably a good thing, Representative.
There's a large list. I haven't counted them. There are more than 20 kinds of exclusions. Some exclusions are permitted by the federal government. Some exclusions are not permitted by the federal government. And what that means is that I hope I get this correct, that it's not a federally permitted exclusion that wage won't be offset in paying that Federal Employment Tax Act wages that are the federal government. So we've got scads and scads of exclusions, and I guess the public policy question has to do with should there be more exclusions, should there be any exclusions. Go back and examine the ones we have, for instance, and you might conclude that the reason this exclusion is here might not be in the best interest of public policy, that it may been the result of a good lobbying effort for one particular session when there were no other bigger fish to fry. There may be very good public policy reasons for the exclusion, but I'm not making giving an opinion on this. But so I can understand Mr. Allen's frustration where he looks over and sees that maybe newspaper people under some circumstances their wages aren't going to be taxed. But they're not independent contractors. They are still employees of the Register Guard or whatever. The employment relationship exists, but whether or not those wages will be taxed and be subject to calculation and receiving benefits is the exclusion that they receive. So it's not that there's no employment relationship. Does that answer your question?
Well, that poses the question for me is why are those exemptions in there for those 20-some exclusions?
Chairman Krupp, because the legislature determined they should be.
I see. That's sort of what I thought, but I didn't know if it was case law or whatever that it would determine that. So, all right. Jim, anything further to add?
Chair Krupp and members of the committee, we see this as a contract and an agreement between a company and an independent contractor. And those individuals have chosen to work this way. They choose an independent approach. And it's all about what we see in America today. It's the freedom and liberty to do what you would like to do. It doesn't exclude them from paying taxes or paying their own insurance, their own liability, whatever they have to do there. And I know as Oregon State Grange, the last thing we want to do is to somehow shield, I guess, these individuals from paying their due as far as taxes are concerned or anything else. And that's not the purpose in this. So it's really up to you as the decision-making body to establish or not to establish the change in statute to address this issue. Or do we push this particular company push them offshore, as we have in America with other regulation continuously, whether it be in land use or whether it be environmental, whatever. We continue to do that. And all we hear today is, in Oregon, we need economic development. And this is a prime example of a wonderful opportunity for economic development. And I'd hate to see all those jobs go offshore. We need to make a change, and you can do that for us. And I think we need to make a commitment that we'll continue in this discussion and how we can design something that will address some of these special situations.
Well, I thank you because I tell you, I sort of feel the same way. I see the summary that I think we all got of recommendations, I think, from for making the case for particular revisions to the statute. And there seems to be some real logic to that because it seems to center around the rural versus urban issue to some extent. But also, you know, Jim, what you brought up about we are in the 21st century, and because of the incredible technological advances of telecommuting, where you know, folks work for Hewlett-Packard and Corvallis by living in their home and working in their home in Lakeview, and we need to recognize that because of technology, perhaps we need to update our statutes, and I think that's logical. Representative Brown, you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment that in bringing this forward today, it was not my intention to reflect any disparity on the department. I realize that they're following statutes as closely as and interpreting and carrying them out like this legislative body created. And I think that it's obvious that that there's some real needs and changes to our some of the public policies we have there, and proposed legislation that I'm asking the legal counsel office now to draft, I think, makes the couple of rather minor changes, I think, that will help small corporations in the rural setting to meet the independent contractor's status and satisfy the requirements that are put upon them by the Employment Department and the Department of Revenue. And as we bring, hopefully we can bring this legislation forth, maybe in the balance of this special session or into the next general regular session, we'll resolve some of these issues so we can keep companies like LRI here and help our rural communities.
Thank you, Representative Brown. Representative King, you have a thought.
Hopefully a little helpful direction that there's been a parade of companies, individuals, who have wanted to get their exception in because they saw there were some other exceptions in there, and after a while you end up with, you know, a book full of exceptions. And you know, if you take exceptions to its logical conclusion, there wouldn't be any jobs left. You know, everybody would be a subcontractor for all kinds of reasons. One is lowering costs. You know, another would be, that wasn't my employee that did that mistake, sue them. You know, they're in business. And so I know that this governor, you know, has seen, you know, that trend, you know, become pretty strong, you know, and has, you know, said we need to not just keep handing out, you know, these exceptions piecemeal. And so I think doing the, you know, the number of outlines that I'm seeing marked out here, you know, I think you're, you know, way past what we can get in the short term, and that also that there are some policy reasons that justify having, you know, these rules in the first place. But I think that what might have some justification is that, you know, the argument that what works in the countryside isn't the same as what works in the city, and you are doing a lot of environmental and not only money improvements for people, but, you know, improving some lifestyles, and that, you know, there may be some justification for, you know, having some, you know, some distance requirement is versus, you know, undoing, you know, the, you know, the, you know, a lot of the structure there, because there's a whole bunch of businesses that would, you know, love to call their employees independent contractors, and you know, that's a, I think it's a door that you don't want to try and open up, especially in the next 48 hours or so, let alone in a regular session.
Thank you, Representative King. Quick question for Renee. And maybe this is for your broader group as a whole. Do you think it would be helpful? I mean, it sounds like maybe there's some confusion amongst businesses like David who wants to employ independent contractors. Do you think it would be helpful if you had, or maybe you do have, kind of a packet of information that you can email people who have subcontractors just so that they're fully aware of the law and the need to comply and the criteria?
Sure, that's something that we're in the process of beginning the discussion on. It's okay. One of the things that has been discussed with me with a number of auditors that I've met with in the last several weeks, that they wish that they had some additional tools to help educate employers in advance of the time that they come knocking on the door to say, well, by the way, you did everything wrong, that having more information available. Quite frankly, Representative, one of the ways that misinformation gets communicated most readily happens to be through accountants who don't know the law and who tell people, all you need to do is make these people independent contractors. So we're trying to establish some relationships with some professional groups, like the accountants, the CPAs, the real estate brokers, so forth, so that we can get that word out. It hasn't happened yet, but that is definitely on the drawing board.
All right.
I think it might also be on the cutting board right now, too.
A lot of things on the cutting board, perhaps.
I didn't do that, but that was something I had meant to follow up on, because, you know, I would think that, you know, that most business attorneys, you know, if they knew that you were getting, you know, most of your work done, you know, through assembly people, that they know that you're bumping up against this, you know, so... You know, that education really is supposed to come from a, you know, pretty decent, you know, business attorney. You know, not the best one, but a, you know, one that's got some product knowledge there.
We believe that we followed all of the rules, and it was.
Your legal counsel advised you that he thought that you
absolutely
you're, okay.
Our people had their own tools,
and the comment in the hearing was that it wasn't a substantial enough of an investment to justify for this rule.
Okay.
Now, when somebody rides their bicycle to us because they have no transportation and they have to go out and buy $50 worth of tools, that is a substantial investment for that person in equipment. Now, a major company such as where we are with a $35,000 CO2 laser that blows away metal and wood, that truly $50 is nothing. But I recognize that when someone owns their own tools, which every subcontractor of us does, that is their investment. And to put a dollar value on whether it counts or not, and that's why that was said as not being that we didn't meet that. And they do. Every person has their own tools.
Okay. I'm glad you have legal advice on that, though.
Yes.
I hope
and
that they've got.
We thought we were totally in compliance.
Thank you. Yeah. Jane, you had a comment?
Yes. Sheriff of the community, one point that we thought we should point out to you is Renee alluded to it that the fund department law, we do have some conformity issues at times with the federal law. And at, we have to do follow those. And one of the things is the definition of employee and how we change this independent contractor law. It may be impacted by the federal law. And so whatever changes there are would have to be ran past them to see if there's conformity issues. And some of the generics of changing employee, depending on where they live or such, that could be an issue. And we just wanted to put that forward. Yeah.
Thank you. That is a very important consideration. When or if Representative Brown would like to move forward with legislation, it would be that would be a critical issue that would have to be dealt with in the process. Well, with that, I think we've heard from everyone, and I appreciate anyone else has anything to say here. Awful, Mr. Osanka, come forward if you can make your comments brief. I'm half hour late for a meeting, so my apologies for running late as always. But welcome, and for the record,
Jeff Osanka from Eugene, LCC instructor and former staffer for the legislature. Some public policy issues that I think you'll need to consider when you're looking at this. The issue seems to the problem seems to have arisen because, as I'm understanding it, somebody who had certified themselves as an independent contractor then applied for unemployment or unemployment benefits, which they could not do if they were indeed an independent contractor. And so what you might want to look at is what sort of certification process there is for the individual to declare themselves an independent contractor. Because it does seem to me that if a person has declared themselves an independent contractor, that would then preclude them from later then seeking unemployment benefits. That is to say, if you go through the process in order to take this sort of employment, and you go through and establish yourself as an independent contractor, it seems to me quite reasonable that you would then give, having received the benefits from being, in theory, an independent contractor, that you should not then be able to receive the benefits for not having been an independent contractor. So
I think if I understood Mr. Allen correctly, the circumstance arose from a carpenter who had been injured, who then became a contractor for LRA, but went back and filed a claim based on his previous employment as a contractor for unemployment, but had to list, as I understand, had to list LRI, and that then I guess opened up the door. But that kind of gets to your issue, though. I think is if you're working as an independent contractor, why should you have to list maybe someone as that you're performing work for? I guess that was never cleared up in my mind as to why that was done.
And
it probably ought to be.
Perhaps once they have declared as an independent contractor, then any claims that they make would be the employment division could determine were not eligible for an audit because they had declared themselves as an independent contractor.
Audit. Yeah.
Otherwise, reading the way this law is being administered, the employer is responsible for determining that all of their independent contractors are complying with every aspect of what we've now seen to be quite a complicated set of procedures. And so it does seem to me that that when you work on your clarification, you might want to look at what sort of responsibility the employer needs to have for determining that he or she, their company, is employing legitimate independent contractors based on statute. If we then, that's a nice easy way of saying it, but you can just imagine the additional work that would require for many companies around the state to go through that process. And yet, if we were to be enforcing things properly, then we would need to enforce it not only for this person, but for all companies that are in similar situations.
Okay. Good point, actually. Very good point.
Well,
13?
I don't want to discuss it forever, but employers aren't necessarily in a good position to be able to define whether that person's an independent contractor, because someone could say, well, I'm an independent contractor, and I don't know whether they really did go out and work for somebody else or not, and so you're kind of on your own. Well, then you get back to, well, then the agency certifies it, and then you're saying, well, we're going to create this new department, and then they're going to have to be verifying that 100 or 200,000 or more people out there in Oregon's workforce are independent contractors according to the rules, and you give them some kind of stamp, which may be good for the moment based on what they know, but that could change based on some of the status, the moving target. So.
Right.
But jobs against this funding, another bureaucratic layer in that department are pretty low.
Exactly. And yet, as I understand it, we're enforcing that on this particular case and presumably other cases in a similar way, but only when it's been triggered by a procedure like this. And so that to me seems to be, I agree with you that there is a problem, Representative King, there, but it does seem to me that you'd want, that it might be then a problem in selective enforcement rather than an overarching public policy issue.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think we ought to discuss this a little further, but not today.
Mm-hmm.
Forgive me. Because it occurs to me that there are literally thousands and thousands of Oregonians who make their living by independent contractor status, particularly in the tech industry. And I think that we would want to hear also, get a little input before we go tinkering with the statutes and change things. We really need to explore any unintended consequences of making changes so that if indeed we do make changes, we do them thoughtfully and carefully and in such a manner that achieves the result that we're looking for and doesn't hurt a whole other industry. Do you know what I mean?
I think those are wise comments, Representative Lowe, and I honestly cannot give you a good read as to whether we're going to be able to work through this issue or not, because we really don't know how quickly our rebalancing issues are going to be resolved. And it may be that we have time to do that, Representative, and it may not be. I think we've gotten a good first start here, and I want to thank all of the presenters and individuals for coming here today. Thank you, Representative Brown, for bringing this issue in front of us. And with that, I'm going to thank you all again, and we are adjourned.